Well, good morning, everyone. Special welcome to you if you are new here. My name is Alex. I'm the pastor of Cascades. Simplicity brings freedom. Duplicity is bondage. Simplicity brings joy and balance. Duplicity brings anxiety and fear. Those are the words of Richard J. Foster. Duplicity, if you're wondering, what is that word? Is just a fancy word for deceitfulness. Deceitfulness is slavery. Deceit is the practice of misleading by concealing or misrepresenting the truth. Now, we're in this series called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. We started this in January. And we started with this vision that life was all about abiding in God. We looked at John chapter 15. Jesus says, abide in me and I in you, that apart from me you can bear no fruit. And then we looked at how hurry is one of the great enemies of spiritual life. How it makes us, how it deforms us, it makes us into people we weren't meant to be. That hurry causes us to actually be unable to be present to God, to others around us, and even to ourselves. And it makes us unable to truly love God or others. Or even ourselves. And so we said, well, how do we work through that? And we said, well, we're going to look at the life of Jesus and look at his practices. And so we started off by looking at the practice of silence and solitude, which was a daily practice. And then we said, we're going to look at a weekly practice, Sabbath. And today we're looking at another practice, the practice of simplicity, which is a lifestyle practice. The goal in all of these is to experience the love and life of God in our everyday. Alan Fading said, the drive to possess is an engine for hurry. The drive to possess is an engine for hurry. And that's an apt description for our cultural moment. That we want things, and now we actually have the ability to get things the same day we order them online, right? Who loves Amazon Prime? Come on, like, it's awesome, right? We have that ability, but that idea that the drive to possess, to own, to have, to consume is this engine of hurry, I think is so apt for where we're at. We have this insatiable desire for more stuff, and it deceives us, our stuff. In the Lord of the Rings, the Ring of Power, it has its power of its own. It's a power that deceives you. It often has this power to actually draw you to itself, and it often plays to your desires. If you know the film, the books, whichever one you love more, you know that Boromir and Sméagol, who becomes Gollum, are undone by the power of the ring. But so is Frodo. Yeah, he's a hobbit, so he's not really fazed by the ring in the same way, but at the very end, when he finally has the opportunity to destroy it by dropping it in the lava of Mount Doom, he can't. Because the ring has actually attached itself to him. He's been attached to it. And so what does he say when he has that chance and he's holding it over it? He says, it's mine. And he takes it back. And it's only this fortunate fall, this grace, that the ring is destroyed. And it's not because he decides to. It's because Gollum bites his finger off, slips, and falls into the lava. That's why the ring's destroyed. That's why we have this good news in that moment, in that story. It's what Tolkien called the U catastrophe. It's when everything looks like it's failed and something beautiful and amazing comes out of it. The ring itself, though, it's deceitful. And you know what else is deceitful? It's materialism. It has that kind of power that the ring has. It has a way of deceiving us, of putting us in bondage. It offers us a gospel, but not the gospel of Jesus Christ. This other gospel says the more you buy, the more you own, the more you accumulate, the happier your life will be. And there's so many problems with this, not the least of that scripture and Jesus never say that. They actually say the exact opposite. Jesus, if anything, declared war on materialism, on the love of money, on greed, on this consumer type of culture, on the love of stuff, on our insatiable desire for more. It's all of this is what's associated with materialism, and it's contrary to the way of Jesus. If you want to see what Jesus says. Look at the Gospels and look at some of the things he says. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus says, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions. If you go on in that same chapter, Jesus says, sell your possessions and give to the poor. Now some of you are like, hold up, come on. Do you know how expensive it is to live here in Vancouver? Do you know about the housing crisis? Do you know about the discrepancy that even though housing costs have increased, wages have not? Do you know about the cost of my rent, my mortgage, my car payments, my debt? What about saving for the future or for retirement? You want me to give all my money away and just pray? Come on. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, he says, so do not worry, saying, what shall we eat? What shall we drink? Or what shall we wear? But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And you say, ha, okay, well, those are the things I worry about most. I need money to pay my bills. Do I need to remind you where I live? I'm just trying to pass on, maybe remind you, if you've heard these words before, what Jesus says. In Mark chapter 4, Jesus says, the worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, and the desires for other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. Okay, come on, wealth is deceitful? Desires suffocate the word that God's trying to plant in my life? That's pretty extreme, Alex. Matthew 19, Jesus says, again, I tell you, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for someone who is rich to enter the kingdom of God. So now wealth is a hindrance to experience life in God's kingdom? Doesn't it make it easier? How does that work? The more money I have, the easier things are for me. I wasn't kidding when I said Jesus declares war on materialism. If there's this awkward tension you're feeling right now with what Jesus teaches and your life values, you're not alone. Jesus' vision for the role of wealth is different than our culture's. Maybe you're not even quite on board with what Jesus is teaching. Or maybe you are, but you feel like you constantly fall back into another way of thinking, into this belief that you can't actually experience the kingdom of God, that you can't experience life with God, the life that he wants for you, where you are right now, through Jesus Christ. And this is the lie that's connected to that gospel of consumerism, that the more you have, the more you acquire, the happier you will be. And you can recognize this with any of those desires. Hey, like if I get that new phone, if I get those new boots, if I get that new position, if I get a new car or that piece of furniture, that weighted blanket that helped me sleep better, oh my gosh, I'll be so much happier once I finally get that, right? If I get it, I'll be happier. Just one click, one more payment, maybe 12 easy payments, right? It's just outside of our grasp, almost there, almost at your happiness. But the gospel of Jesus Christ is something fundamentally different. It says that through Jesus' sacrificial death and resurrection, you have access to the love of the Father and his presence right now, that nothing actually separates you from that. It doesn't matter your past, your shame, your sin, what you'll do in the future, what's been done to you, none of that separates you from the love of the Father. It doesn't matter what life stage you're in, it doesn't matter your income, it doesn't matter your health, nothing separates you from the love and presence of the Father through Jesus Christ. That's the good news. Yet in our moment right now, there's this guy, his name is John Billiard. I can't even say his last name, it's French. He says, it's not atheism that's replaced Christianity as the key system for meaning. It's actually materialism. Cultural Christianity has been replaced by shopping. Our meaning comes from what we consume. Amazon is that new temple, and our credit card bills, it's the altar. And there's a reason why Jesus called money or wealth, mammon, a god that you cannot worship. Now, our culture wasn't always like this. You can trace out the developments of this consumer economy all the way back to the end of the Second World War, where we had to shift our economies. We used to actually have an economy where that was oriented towards what we needed. And during the war, it was a wartime economy, and it was very productive. And as the war ended, we needed to find a new economy, a something, a new focus to shift on. And what started to develop at this time was one based on consumer desires and not needs. People usually think that marketing and advertising came out of Madison Avenue, but where it really started was in Berlin with propaganda and how they were able to convince people of what was best for a nation. And when the war ended, those same techniques were used to market to us, to tell us what we should desire, that we really needed it in order to be happy. Greg Easterbrook, he's written this book called The Progress Paradox, How Life Gets Better While People Feel Worse. He says this: adjusting for population growth, 10 times as many people in Western nations today suffer from unipolar depression or unremitting bad feelings without a specific cause than did a half century ago. Americans and Europeans, you can throw Canadians in there too, have ever more of everything except happiness. Think about this. I grew up with, like, remember when internet, you had to like use your like landline and you'd hear that terrible noise when you'd pick up the phone? Like, we have wireless internet right in our pocket. We have, you know, like all these smart devices. We have things that are supposed to make our lives easier, yet somehow we're not happier. We have more stuff, but that doesn't actually mean that we are happier people. Something's off. What do we do then? Should we just reject all those things? Throw our phone out the window? Right? Ian says yes. He's nodding his head in approval. Should we reject modern plumbing and just dig an outhouse in the back or whatever? No. Like, should we reject our cars? No. The problem isn't stuff. That's asceticism. It renounces all possessions and sees it as bad. But the biblical story says that God created the world and he actually declared it good. So there's something else that's wrong. We place no limits on the stuff that we want due to our desire for more. We think we need all sorts of things to be happy when we need a few. Paul, in 1 Timothy chapter 6, he writes, if we have food and clothing, we will be content with that. And for Paul, a follower of Jesus, and Jesus and his disciples living in and around the Mediterranean, that would have been enough. But we live in Vancouver, so you could throw one more in there and say, hey, we need a roof. It rains a lot here, okay? It's pretty wet, right? So shelter, food, clothing. Now, I'm not really a betting guy at all, but I'd be willing to bet some of you hear that and you're like, that's ridiculous, Alex. Just food, just clothing, and just a roof. And now you want me to be happy with that? Like, that doesn't really work. If that's you, just suspend judgment for a second. What if the only material things we really needed to live rich lives and satisfying lives are food to eat, clothes on our back, and a place to live? And if you feel unable to actually believe that, then I'd say that propaganda machine's actually working. It's working really well right now. Remember that other gospel that the more stuff we have, the more money we have, the happier we will be? Well, the reality is that only works up until a certain point. And that in reality, it actually only works for those who are poor. What's that number, that amount? Well, there was a Nobel Prize-winning psychologist, Daniel Kahneman, and a respected economist, Dr. Angus Deaton. They spent several months studying data from over 400,000 Gallup surveys, and they concluded this. This is what Angus Deaton wrote. No matter where you live, your emotional well-being is as good as it's going to get at $75,000 a year. And money's not going to make it any better beyond that point. It's like you hit some sort of ceiling and you can't get emotional well-being much higher just by having more money. $75,000 annually. Now, sure, that doesn't really go as far in our city than it would in certain rural parts, right? But that's the average. So obviously in other places, that's going to seem like a ton. But when you reach that stage, it doesn't matter how much more you add, you're not getting happier. This is just the law of diminishing returns. It doesn't make you happier. But Can you see then how that belief that the more we accumulate, the more we have, the more that we own and consume, the happier we'll be, actually distorts reality? Richard Foster called this view of things actually psychotic. It's unhealthy. And if you haven't gathered, materialism is destructive to our souls. It's one of the reasons why happiness is dropping, despite the fact that we have more and more, is because it's actually speeding our culture and society up to an unsustainable pace. It encourages hurry. See, we often think about the things that we want to buy only in terms of what they cost us financially, but we don't often think about what they cost us in terms of our time. So think about a house. You just think, oh, it's going to cost several hundred thousand dollars or a million if you want to live in Vancouver to own that. But we don't think about the time it's going to take to say, okay, well, once I have that place and I'm there, I got to spend time cleaning it. So if you want a bigger house, it takes more time to clean it. You got to fill it with furniture. You got to spend time figuring out, okay, now I got to take care of the lawn. Or you got to work more so you can pay someone to take care of your lawn, right? These are the time costs that we don't often think about, but you just attach this to anything. Think about a computer. You're like, okay, I got to buy a new computer. You think about the money, but you also got to think about, hey, I got to learn how to use it. I got to learn the new software. I got to spend that time fixing it if something goes wrong. If you want to get a motorcycle, you're like, okay, well, I got to get a license, so I got to get trained. I got to pay for that. I got to maintain it. There's all these things we don't think about when it comes to our time. We only think about the money. And see, with less time, it just means more hurry. We have so many things, but we don't have enough time to actually enjoy those things at a healthy pace. And so if you come back to Jesus' words at the very beginning, what if Jesus was right? What if, when he says, be on guard against all kinds of greeds, life does not consist in an abundance of possessions? What if he was right? The worries of this life, the deceitfulness of wealth, the desires of other things come in and choke the word, making it unfruitful. What if his way actually is better to live? What if, when we embrace Jesus' way, we lay up treasure for ourselves as a firm foundation for the coming age and take hold of the life that is truly life, as Paul writes in Timothy chapter 6. What if that formula of more stuff equals more happiness is just wrong? It's bad math. What if more stuff just means more stress, more debt, more years of working a job that we don't feel passionate about or called to, more time wasted cleaning, maintaining, fixing, playing with, organizing, reorganizing, updating junk that we don't really need? What if it means that more stuff actually leads to less time for what actually matters most? There's less freedom, less generosity, which Jesus said was actually better, that it was more of a blessing to give than it was to receive. There's less peace, less margin, less time for prayer, less for the time for the things our hearts actually ache for. John Mark Comer, he writes this, he says, in reality, Jesus' moral teaching aren't arbitrary at all. They are laws, yes, but moral laws are no different from scientific laws like E equals MC squared or gravity. They are statements about how the world actually works. And if you ignore them, not only do you rupture relationship with God, but you also go against the grain of the universe he created. Cue the splinters. So many of Jesus' teachings, especially on money and stuff, were just telling stories about the way the world actually is. So what is Jesus' way where we take hold of the life that is truly life? That's what we want to know. It's a life of simplicity. And Jesus paints a picture for this in Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. We're going to look at that. We're going to start in verse 19. And we're going to stop at different points. So if you have a Bible, you can do that, or you can follow along behind me. Jesus says in verse 19, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal, but store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moth and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. See, none of the stuff here on earth, it's ultimately not that secure. And back in Jesus' day, they didn't have banks where you put all your stuff, so people would bury it. They'd kind of have it underground, and so that's why it wasn't secure, but it's still not secure for us today. And Jesus says in verse 21, "For where your treasure is, there your heart will be." Whatever you treasure most in this world is where your heart is. Whatever you guard and seek to protect, that's what you treasure. You keep reading in verse 22, Jesus says, "The eye is a lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" A bad eye on a sick eye was an idiom for greed. A good eye then meant you were actually generous. Now, we usually think of greed and we think of someone like Scrooge, right? Someone else, not us. Of course not us. But what Jesus is getting at here is that when you have this greed, it blinds you. It blinds you to reality. And so you don't see your stuff and your money the way you were meant to. You see it differently. We hold on to that stuff. We think that we will have it all of our lives, and we collect it. We want more. We think that that more of it will actually satisfy our deepest wants. We think that we have to protect it all the time. We lose sight of the fact that it's all His, that He's the one that provides. He even cares for those things. And that when we die, we don't get to take it with us. If you read in verse 24, Jesus goes on to say, "No one can serve two masters. You will either hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money or wealth, mammon." No one can. You can't. You should not. You can't serve God and money. And then He says something. We usually just stop there, but if you keep reading in the very next line, in verse 25, Jesus says, "Therefore." What's it there for? Well, you got to look back. What's He just talked about? He's talking about how there's no point in trying to store up for ourselves all of these things, trying to collect more and more and more, when it won't even be secure. He says, store it up in heaven. Have a different focus. Have a different thing to treasure up. Serve Him. And then He gets to this, "Therefore I tell you, do not worry about your life, what you will eat or drink, or about your body, what you will wear. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothes?" Do you see what Jesus does in that moment, though? Jesus is saying that money, your things, they're actually connected to worry. Therefore, do not worry. Jesus ties money and things, all these things together, into one long teaching on worry. If you keep reading in this section, Jesus again will mention worry. See, the things we worry about are things we actually are worshiping. And if you worship your money, it's going to eat you alive. Jesus' solution to all of this is simplicity. Some people call it simple living. Ken Shigematsu would call it simple abundance. Monks would have called it frugality, but we don't like that word because it sounds cheap. So we're like, yeah, I'm not frugal. I'm not, right? People today call it minimalism. Let's make clear what simplicity is not. It's not style and architecture or design in modern homes. It's not Scandinavian furniture, okay? Even though the stuff is nice, it's not that. It's not poverty. Simplicity is not poverty or barren, joyless life and no freedom to enjoy material things. It's not organizing your closet. Marie Kondo is awesome, but that's not what this is. This is broader. Simplicity is about living with less, not nothing. Asceticism rejects possession of all things because it actually has a view of it that isn't good. It's not a biblical view, though. So what is simplicity? Joshua Becker, he's a follower of Jesus. He puts it like this. It's the intentional promotion of the things we value most and the removal of everything that distracts us from them. Intentional promotion of the things we most value and the removal of everything that distracts us from them. Richard Foster has also written on this topic. He says, "Simplicity is an inward reality that can be seen in an outward lifestyle." Notice that neither of these definitions for simplicity speak of money or possessions. That's because that's not the focus. It's about our whole lives. It's a lifestyle that starts within us, as Foster notes, in our hearts, about what we're actually treasuring. And then on the outside, you see in terms of the intentional choices we make, in terms of what we're going to prioritize, in terms of what we're going to say is most important. The practice of simplicity means that we intentionally prioritize our time, our money, our talents, our possessions towards what matters most, with everything being left to the side that isn't that. And the goal isn't to clean out our closet or our garages. Well, those things probably need to be done. It's to clean out our lives, to actually declutter our lives. To clean out what, though? It's those things that distract us, that overstimulate us to the point where that we're numb to them. We don't even notice them anymore. And we don't even notice or pay attention to the things that matter most. St. Francis de Sales was a bishop in Geneva, and he said, "In everything, love simplicity." Now, maybe you're like, "Okay, Alex, this seems kind of hazy. What do you mean when you talk about simplicity? These definitions, I hear them, but I'm not seeing what they're tangibly like." Well, Jesus puts it really simply in Matthew chapter 6. He just says in verse 33, "But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness." The very first thing, your number one priority, what are you going to seek? It's his kingdom and his righteousness, the presence of God, his goodness, his love. It's all available for you in Jesus, who brought the kingdom. To seek the kingdom is to seek God's presence and his will. And this, Jesus is saying, is the antidote to our worry. It's a very, very narrow and simple focus, but it's central to dealing with our insatiable desire for more. It's redirecting our hearts by saying, "My heart is actually set on your kingdom, God, and your righteousness. That's what I want first." Now, maybe you hear this and a voice inside of you saying, "Actually, Alex, like, this is totally just for rich people. This is just like a privileged way of looking at things." I would say, you're right, but you should be really careful over who you're calling rich and who you're saying is poor. No one usually thinks they're rich. But to put things in perspective, according to World Bank economist Branko Milanovic in his book, The Haves and the Have-Nots, if you make $25,000 a year or more, you're in the top 10% of the world's wealth. When we're looking at the world, we're not looking at Vancouver, we're looking at the world. If you make 25 grand or more, 25 grand a year, you're in the top 10%. That's all you got to make. If you make $34,000 a year, get this, you're in the top 1%. I think that gives us a little more perspective. It's not supposed to make us feel guilty, but it should give us perspective when we think about this world that we live in. And it also should help us understand, like, yeah, we actually are wealthy. We don't always think of ourselves as that. When we read all those passages in Scripture about how, you know, Jesus or Paul speaking about people who are wealthy, we're like, "Oh, that's not me." Maybe next time we read them, we actually should think of ourselves as those people. Jesus practiced this life of simplicity. He lived in this happy tension, and it is a tension of simplicity. Jesus ate with wealthy people. He was accused of being a glutton and a drunkard because he was appreciating good things, food, wine. People were looking at him being like, "Oh man, this guy is just taking license everywhere." His clothes were valuable enough where when he died, these Roman centurions were actually like gambling over it because they wanted it. He was supported when he had his public ministry by a group of wealthy donors that paid for his food and his travel expenses. So he lived in this tension. We're not saying, look, we don't ever touch money, we don't ever like work for it. No, of course not. That stuff is bad. No, we're not saying that. But Jesus had this carefree unconcern for possessions, and it's a mark of a life that lives in the kingdom. And for those of us who want to follow Jesus and embrace his way, that we're devoted to him and his way, we have that same task where we pursue this life of a carefree unconcern for possessions. And I want to give you four practical ways where you can start to simplify. Now, what I'm about to go through, if you want like details on it, all of this is going to be available in the back. There's some sheets for how you can practically do this. If you're in a community group, you already have it. It was emailed to you. For the first three, we're going to have the same type of framework. So I'm going to go through the framework, and then we'll just apply it into those three areas. And then the last one, it will be a little bit different. So for the first three, you're going to want to have five piles. The first pile is going to be a pile that you make that's for keeping. Things that you actually use, things that you care about, things that are valuable and bring joy. The second pile is going to be things you need to give away to your friends, your family, or people you know in need. You're going to have a third pile that's going to be for selling. You want to make a little bit of money, right? So you sell those things that are actually still valuable for someone. And the fourth pile is you're going to throw away certain things or recycle them. We do live in Vancouver. Recycling matters, guys, right? And then the fifth one is important. It's waiting. The fifth one, it's the things you're like, I actually don't know. You're kind of emotionally attached to it. You'd be surprised how many things you're emotionally attached to. But when you start cleaning out those closets and those different spaces, you're like, oh, I don't know if I should get rid of that. Why? You haven't thought about it for a year. I know, but I don't know, right? Those things go in the weight pile. You put them in a box or a bag, whatever you want, and you're going to put them back in your garage or your closet and leave them there for 3 to 6 months. Okay? If you want anything in that pile later on, you can go grab it. But here's the thing. When you revisit it in 3 to 6 months, it's going to be a lot easier to get rid of if you realize you haven't thought about it at all. Okay? So here's the first area. It's your clothes. It's your closets. You're going to make those five piles. You can take everything out, throw it on a pile, and then just categorize them based on those five different things of keep, give away, sell, throw away, recycle, or wait. And the things you're going to keep, you put them back in an organized way. This will make you face like, oh, wow, there's so many things I haven't worn in like who knows how long. Oh, I've just been saving it for that one time I go camping. Come on, if you haven't gone camping in 6 years, I think it's okay. You can probably get rid of it, okay? Now, when you do this, you want to pick up maybe a level for how intense you want to go into this, because you could basically refine what you have and by recreating this pile five times and just continuously narrowing down. But you can also do something like say, okay, well, I actually just want to live with like six outfits per season, right? And that's it, right? Those are my six outfits. I'm good with that. And you purge everything else. You might go in more intense and say, I want to have three outfits. That's it. And I have them for season. There's this one, I think it's like a TEDx talk that someone talked about where they did a three-month challenge where they dressed with 33 items or less for those 3 months. If you want details on that and the link, it's in the notes. The second area you can do this with is your stuff. We all have lots of stuff. You can start with the smallest room. It's probably the best place to start, like a linen closet or your bathroom. Do not start with your garage or like that huge room. You want to leave that for last. You want to do the five piles thing again, your keep, give away, sell, recycle, throw away, and wait. And you want to carefully put all the things you're going to keep back in an organized way. Now, a few guiding principles. They're guiding principles. These aren't like law, okay? So don't hear them like that. The first would be avoid collections. You don't really need a mug for every single city you visited, okay? You don't need those DVDs from 1995, okay? You know it's getting close to home when you start audibly saying, hey, watch it, okay? What else here? The same goes for VHS if you still have it, okay? It's not just DVDs. I'm not out against that. You know, some questions you might want to ask, though, as you go through these things are, does it spark joy? Shout out Marie Kondo. Do this prayerfully without guilt. Maybe just ask, is there someone that needs this? Those sentimental items, you want to leave them for last, okay? Because those are the ones that are hardest to work through and deal with. So just leave them for last. The third area you can do this very same process with is the papers in your house. And you know what I'm talking about. Everybody's got that one drawer. Mail comes in, throw it in there, close it. Right? You don't want to see it. You have guests coming over, all the papers bunch up and just shove it in there. Like, oh, my house is clean. No, it's not. Just when people come over. right? So you want to make those five piles. And one of the things that's going to be different about your papers is a lot of that stuff you can recycle, and things you think you need to keep, you can just take a photo of and or get a digitizer. For a lot of our photo albums, we can do that. Now, I know some of you are like, okay, I like having the tangible one. Fine, I get it. But we really don't need that for a lot of things. And that clutter just builds up in our homes. Once you do that, you can just reorganize it and put it back away. And I would say for this one, you want to give yourself lots of time. Give yourself time because it takes time. So give yourself a week, more than a week, sorry. And remember, recycle. Paper can be recycled. The fourth way, and I'd say this one is, it's different, but it will really impact your daily life, is by simplifying with your budget and your schedule. And so let's look at a schedule first. It's creating a fixed hour schedule. And that's literally what it is. Your hours are fixed. And so you want to get out your weekly calendar or whatever it is. And you want to actually think through the things that matter. If we're saying the kingdom of God, I want to seek his kingdom and his righteousness. Now, how do I put that in a schedule? You start thinking through what it looks like for you to follow Jesus right now. And you put that in. And so there's really basic practical things you want to do. Like you need rest. So set your bedtime. Some of you do this already, but just set it and set the time you're going to wake. And we usually need more sleep than we think. Then you want to put in your spiritual practices, things like silent solitude, your Sabbath, church, morning prayer, and you actually just put them in for when you're actually going to spend that time doing it. You do the same for your core relationships, your family, or date nights, your community group, because we all know everyone's in a community group, right, guys? And then we'll do that with our daily health habits, things like exercise, reading, play, when you're going to have your family movie nights or hiking on Saturdays, whatever those things are. You put them in. And then your key work habits for your day, like day planning, your deep work when you do your most productive work, or your meetings, and you set your times for emails so that you're not going to check your email all day. You're just going to check it at certain times of the day. And that's it. And finally, you actually want to make sure there's margin because we're not robots. So we need space to process. We need space sometimes just to think through things. And so what you're doing with this is you're deciding in advance what is most important in your life. And you're not living by the tyranny of the urgent. You're actually saying, these things matter, and I'm actually going to prioritize them. Because I say they matter with my words, but I actually want my life to be consistent with that. The second thing there is creating a budget. And so if you're an Excel person, you're probably going to love this if you don't do it already. But grab a calculator, a spreadsheet, and your pay stub. And what you want to do is just work through creating a budget. And so you can calculate what you want to tithe, what you want to, outside of your tithe, just give towards work that you love that's happening in our city or in our world, because your heart is to actually be one who is generous. And this is you just being intentional with it. There's different methods you can use for budgeting. Some people love Dave Ramsey's Financial Peace University. There's a guy named Mark Scrandet who's got a template called Free. It's a great resource as well. What you'll want to do is live under your means, not at it, not over it, of course. This is actually going to be huge for us, because many times that anxiety, that worry, that stress is actually coming from us pushing ourselves to the brink. But when we leave margin and leave room for it, we're actually able to be more generous. We actually have more time. Now, with these, your schedule and your budget, if this is new for you, try it for a month. Commit for 1 month, 30 days at least. Because you're trying to get into a new way of thinking, a new practice, and that takes time. I'd say don't try all four of these things at once. You'll be overwhelmed. That's not the idea. You're trying to unhurry. And the other thing you'll want to do is actually share your schedule and your budget with someone you trust, like your roommate, your spouse, someone that's going to hold you to account, and someone that can encourage you so that they see, look, this is what I desire to do with my time and my money. I just want you to check in with me. And I trust you and I respect you, and I need your help because I can't do this on my own. And then you'll just want to adjust whenever you need to. Now, why would we do these things? Well, the goal in all of this isn't to just put a little check mark and say, like, close, done, stuff done, you know, my papers done, my budget, my schedule done. That's not what this is about. The goal in these things is to unhurry. It's to move away from these lives of overconsumption and constant worry and to grasp the life that God has for us. It's to walk with Jesus and to work with him, to learn his unforced rhythms of grace, to keep company with him and to learn to live freely and lightly. But it's also because there's actually a cost to our contentment. See, we're doing these things because we want more of God, but there's actually something that happens as we work through. We recognize it still does cost us time and changing our habits. We also get to live a different type of life where there's more time for prayer, an uncrushed soul. Paul in Philippians chapter 4 writes this famous verse. People love it. It's a motivational line for many. People write it on their shoes. They got like little wristbands that says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Many times people use this out of context, though. And what Paul is writing about is about contentment. If you read this verse in context, if you start in verse 11, he says, I'm not saying this because I am in need, for I have learned to be content whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all things through him who gives me strength. It's different when we think of it like that, when we see what Paul's writing about. He's writing about one of the great enemies of our soul, this discontentment, that feeling and yearning for more. Even just of all of it, of more of life, of all of it. On contentment, John Mark Comer writes, living in such a way that your unfulfilled desires no longer curb your happiness. We all live with unfulfilled desires. In this life, we all our symphonies remain unfinished. But this doesn't mean we can't live happy. And we can live happy because of the good news of Jesus Christ, that he has come, that nothing will separate us from the love of God. Not our wealth status, not our life stage, not our health, not our sin, not our shame, not any of it. None of it will separate us from him. This is the good news of Jesus Christ. This is why even though we live these lives, like he talks about as like these symphonies that never finish, where we live with these unfulfilled desires, we can actually live lives of satisfaction because in Jesus Christ, we have the life that we were made for. And there's a day where he will return and actually restore his creation. And our lives and the way people interact with one another will be as if they were truly meant to be. And in here, we're learning how to live the way of Jesus here on earth right now. We don't need more stuff. See, Jesus, though he is the very nature of God, didn't grasp onto equality with God. No, for the joy set before him, he actually endured the cross, despising its shame, so that we could be reconciled to the Father, so that we could have life with him. And this is the good news. The question for us is, will we embrace Jesus' way of simplicity? Well, here's a really simple way we can do that as his people this morning. We have bread and juice. Jesus took these two very simple symbols to tell a very powerful story. It's the greatest story ever told. That this life that is truly life is available right now in his death and in his resurrection. The bread and the juice tell the gospel story. That Jesus' body was broken so that his creation and humanity could actually be healed. His blood was shed so our creation could actually be washed clean, his people washed clean and made new. And when we do this, as his people, we declare that truth to one another and we give thanks. It's a remembrance, but it's more than a remembrance. And so here's what we're going to do. We're going to pass the bread around. I'm going to ask you to just take it, hold it, and we'll eat together, and then we'll do the same with the cup. And we'll eat as God's people. Father in heaven, I give you thanks for your son, Jesus, for his way. that he invites us into, where we rediscover what it means to truly live, where we find our true joy in you. Lord, I pray that this teaching wouldn't be something that is a discouragement or a burden, but rather an invitation to live in a new way, empowered by your Holy Spirit, filled with your joy. We thank you for your body broken, Jesus, and your blood shed. As we eat, we desire to feast with you. In your name, amen.